Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know we're gonna
have a soul-utopia. Many things we found. We started to burn many things we found. This is the Soul-utopia Green Power and Wellness Show. I'm Harvey Wasserman, back with you for another hour here on a Monday on the Eastern Time. We are talking today about a couple things of great importance. We're going to start again with the San Onofre nuclear plant and the various aspects of what's going on there with our resident expert, Ace Hoffman, calling him from Southern California to give us a lowdown on this horrific potential Fukushima that Southern California Edison wants to open. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Bob Petrakis, my partner in crime and in grime for over the last 20 years, for a long discussion of voter rights and what's happening to our electoral system, especially in light of a likely Supreme Court decision that we're expecting that may overturn some of the primary and important safeguards that have been put in place for voter rights. So we have a full show, and we hope you'll stay with us through the hour. Bob is on the line, but we're going to start with Ace Hoffman. Ace, tell us, please, the latest developments here in the attempt by Southern California Edison to reopen the San Onofre nuclear plant. I know you've got a report coming out this week that we want to highlight about some new technical findings that you've made. So fill us in, please, on what's happening.
Okay, well, on Wednesday, Harvey, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is planning to have a meeting in Maryland, to 2,500 miles away from San Onofre, where it's safe.
This is at their office.
At their offices. It will be webcast, and they're going to discuss the proposed license amendment request from Southern California Edison to restart Unit 2 at 70% power. And discuss whether or not they've answered all the technical questions regarding the steam generator tube integrity. So prior to that happening, we want to release a report, the safety team that I'm working with, that discusses all of the things, or as many as we could find, that are missing, have been missing all along. The concept, for example, the San Onofre has been determining that it will be safe to restart because the tube-to-tube wear, that's when the tubes bang into each other, and they wear a little bit off of their dime-thin coating, and if that wear gets past 35%, then they have to shut down. And they've decided that the tube wear will not go past 35%. But they're completely ignoring another kind of tube wear, which is called fatigue wear. That's the cracks that would happen if you did bend something back and forth a whole lot of times. That's different from the rubbing wear.
So Southern California Edison, which has had these two reactors shut since a year ago, January, and folks who were, you know, this may sound like it's a California issue, and I'm actually in California right now talking about this with Ace Hoffman, who's also in California, but the reality is that these two reactors are on the in a tsunami zone, in an earthquake zone, and could really do to the United States what Fukushima has done to Japan. And then some, although there were three explosions that we know of at Fukushima. Only two reactors hit San Onofre, but God forbid anything like this should happen. Now, Southern California Edison's trying to open these plants. There will be a hearing I guess it's not really a hearing, is it? It's just a discussion with the NRC, Nuclear Regulatory Commission, on Wednesday. It's going to be webcast. And what is Southern California Edison hoping to accomplish in this meeting?
As far as I can tell, they're hoping to obfuscate the issue and avoid public scrutiny. What they're really trying to do is they're trying to get permission to restart and then have if necessary, a more thorough hearing after restart, which is kind of backwards.
Yes, it is. Well, that's the way the industry operates. Now, I read a lead editorial in the Wall Street Journal the last couple of days, which asserted that because San Onofre was offline last summer, over a million homes in Southern California were without power. That's a blatant lie, isn't it?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it really jumped out at me. Here it is, right in the Wall Street Journal, right in their lead editorial, something that's patently false. Are we expecting blackouts and brownouts this summer if San Onofre is still offline?
Well, we have a group that checks what the status of the grid is at all times, and they've been saying that we will not be experiencing blackouts, and in fact we have 30 to 40% more power than we need for an average day, and more than enough even for a sunny day when there's
yeah.
much
it gets and warm. Of course Southern California Edison has been dragging its feet. It's had over a year now to install replacement solar energy, wind energy, tidal, geothermal, but primarily solar and increased efficiency. And what have they done about that, Ace Hoffman?
They've done practically nothing. There's been no effort to get the demand response where you turn off the air conditioners for maybe an hour if necessary. That's hardly been implemented. The solar rooftop programs, there was talk about a million rooftops in California, but we don't have that. We've got maybe 1% of that have solar right now. I mean,
and if Southern California Edison had pushed ahead and aggressively with renewable replacements for San Onofre, where would we be now?
Well, they had something like $750 million that they could have spent that was just waiting to be spent over the last year and a half. As far as I know, most if not all of that is still waiting to be spent. I mean, there's money to be put into these projects, and they're cost effective in a relatively short run, and yet they won't do them because nothing can beat the price of a nuclear reactor where you don't have to pay for the damages, you don't have to pay for the spent fuel afterwards, and the ratepayers are going to pay for everything that all the maintenance and operations costs, even if the reactor's down.
And now Southern California Edison has redefined, Southern California Edison is licensed to operate San Onofre at 100% of its rated power. Now they say they want to go at just 70% on Unit 2. Why is that?
Mainly because they know that there's no calculation on Earth that's going to tell them that it's safe to run it at 100% for the full 22 months. So they've cut down the number of months they're going to run from 22, the expected normal number, to 5. And they want to cut the power from 100% to 70% because they think that that will eliminate the possibility of something called fluid elastic instability, which is where all the tubes are vibrating together and banging into each other. But the reasons that they give for why they think that'll happen do not jive with what most of the experts that I've seen reports from are saying. I mean, it's really mind-boggling how Southern California Edison can still be trying to get that reactor started on some kind of loophole, even though all sorts of experts outside the industry, directly connected, have been saying this will be dangerous if you do it.
And so essentially, Southern California Edison, which has installed at the cost of $765 million, a new set of turbines, of steam generators. Wants to reopen Unit 2, essentially on an experimental basis. And they want to run an experiment with 8 million people in a 50-mile radius on these steam generators that, all for all intents and purposes, look like they're going to fail.
And they're blatantly defying logic and engineering principles that, every expert that we can find. I haven't found an independent expert that agrees with San Onofre that's going to put his reputation on the line without any money, incentive to do so. The experts are teams of people from the nuclear industry are the only ones that are even coming close to it. And their documents are contradictory, the ones that Southern California Edison is relying on. They're picking and choosing the facts that they want out of those documents. I mean, we're far from reality here.
So what we're asking now is, among other things, is that people should call the office of Senator Barbara Boxer and ask Senator Boxer to hold a hearing on this potential restart and tell the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that they can't license this thing until this hearing has been held. I think, you know, people always ask, what can we do? What can we do? I think it's time to flood. And Senator Boxer has been very good on the nuclear issue. She's issued a letter with Representative Ed Markey pointing out that Southern California Edison knew these this turbine was defective and went ahead and installed it anyway. And so, Ace, I think you're going to issue your report this week, and I'm going to ask people listening in to please call the office of Senator Boxer and demand that your report be given a full public vetting and that there be a public hearing, an adjudicated hearing where people have to testify under oath before this plant, before the NRC can license this plant. Does that sound reasonable?
That would be wonderful, and let me give you the name of who we are and also Barbara Boxer's phone number.
Please.
We are the DAB safety team, the DAB safety team, and Barbara Boxer's phone number. And we're comprised of a couple of activists who are working, who've been working very hard on this subject for thousands of hours just since the steam generator failure last year, and some experts that worked at the plant for more than a decade, and a variety of unnamed experts who are associated. Some of them are ex-NRC investigators and people, renowned people within the industry, are all working on this. And we need Barbara Boxer and others to pay attention to what we're saying, because we think we've nailed it pretty well, that this reactor cannot be restarted. So here's Barbara Boxer's phone number. It's in Washington, of course, 202-224-3553.
Good. I want to repeat that, please.
202-224-3553.
All right. Well, Bob Fitrakis, are you with us there?
Yes, I am, Harvey.
Okay, Bob, we're ready to go in a minute here. Let me just wrap up with Ace. Ace, we really appreciate your time and your great work. Be sure when you post this report that you give me a URL so that I can repost it at nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, which is where I post all your stuff. I keep going back to San Onofre because we have two reactors shutting in the United States this year that we know of, Kewaunee in Wisconsin, Crystal River in Florida. We desperately need these two reactors at San Onofre to shut, or they are shut, actually, to be permanently shut, because they are endangering the entire United States and certainly Southern California, 8 million people in a 50-mile radius. These two reactors are on earthquake faults, in a tsunami zone, right on the ocean. My God, if you see pictures of it, it's on a cliff. Over, if that cliff fell in, those reactors would go plunging right into the surf. This is insane. Thank you, Ace, so much for your good work. I'm convinced we're going to win this one, and we'll keep doing that. Everybody, please call Barbara Boxer's office and watch nuke3.org for the posting of this report. Okay, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Harvey.
All right. We are now on with the great Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator for the last more than 20 years, among other things, on issues of electoral integrity, and we're going to devote the rest of the hour to this because, among other things, we're looking at some very serious Supreme Court decisions that there seems to be consensus that the court is about to overturn a key piece of the Civil Rights Act, and we want people to understand that this is the tip of the iceberg. Bob and I have co-authored, I think it's 5 books already on election integrity, and we've got one more coming out as soon as we put in a summary essay, which we're going to discuss now. Bob, what do you think about the possibility of the Supreme Court overturning Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act? What kind of impact is that going to have?
Well, I think it'll continue the trend to create the new Jim Crow. Part of the problem right now, Harvey, is you and I have written about beginning, you really in the book, What Happened in Ohio, is the targeting of black voters, the deliberate racist targeting of black voters because of their propensity to vote Democratic has spread throughout the United States, particularly in Ohio in 2004 and as well as in 2012 when there's been Republican Secretary of State. So their solution to the growing problem of purging black voters from the election rolls and from forcing them to vote provisionally, second-class, back-of-the-bus ballots, is to eliminate the provision of the law that requires the old southern states, the Jim Crow states, to justify their activity. What they should be talking about is expanding this to the whole country, since it's now across the Mason-Dixon line, and states like Ohio are just hotbeds of racist purges.
We'll talk about that. Let's get explicit. Well, first of all, the Section 5 of the Civil Rights Act gives the Justice Department the power to go into states where there's demonstrable discrimination in the voting process based on race and attempt to fix it. Is that a fair assessment of what Section 5 does?
Well, the 105 really requires the you have to get any changes in your election system pre-approved by the Justice Department. Hence, the mass purges. Remember back in 2004, if Ohio had been under that section of the law, and I think now it deserves to be, remember Ken Blackwell came in and consolidated all these inner-city voting wards.
Kenneth Blackwell was the Republican Secretary of State who was visited on Election Day by Karl Rove and George W. Bush and magically flipped Ohio's votes from John Kerry to George W. Bush.
But what he did is, because it's a two-pronged attack, Harvey, as you well know, they start with massive voter repression targeting black voters. So they came into my area of the inner city. I live on the near east side here of Columbus in a black neighborhood. And a tenth of a mile away, I could walk to my polling place at the old First Presbyterian Church. So Blackwell closes that down. He moves me more than a half mile away to a model neighborhood facility. That type of reorganization, where essentially you're making it more difficult for people to vote. And then on his webpage, he failed to update the new voting sites. So on election day, it was absolute chaos when people weren't informed that their voting site had been closed and they'd been moved farther away. Now, under the 105 section, you can't do that. You can't massively rearrange, consolidate, eliminate the voting places in the inner cities without the Justice Department pre-approving it. And if that had been done in Ohio, regardless of their vote flip, Kerry would have likely won because it disenfranchised somewhere between 70 and 90,000 voters. And remember the lines as well, is that you wait in line for 6 hours to vote, and then you get to the line, and they tell you you're at the wrong polling place.
And then they give you a provisional ballot, and we know that the provisional ballots were not counted.
Right, and that would, under 105, Ken Blackwell in 2004 changed Ohio's practice as Secretary of State. In the old days, if you were in the right polling place but the wrong precinct, or even in the right county, and you voted, your vote for president still counted. Anything above the county level, for example, Senate, any statewide office, president, you still counted that vote. You just discounted if you were in the your precinct vote, for example. And Blackwell changed that history of counting those statewide votes. Under the 105 provision, which the Supreme Court wants to eliminate, is they can do that throughout the South. They can adopt these new tactics without any supervision that are essentially targeting black people for elimination of their votes.
And so we're expecting a 5-4 vote on this. And so what's going to happen now is that the court will strip the Justice Department of any power to try and rectify these abuses. Is that basically what we're about here?
Yeah, no, essentially you're allowing the historically most racist Jim Crow Klan-infested regions of the country to have the right to decide what they're going to do on election day. I'm waiting for them to bring back the white-only primary.
Yeah, well, that would be, of course, Indiana. but, okay, so let's look now at the entirety, and you are really the leading, or one of the leading experts on election procedures. You've been to El Salvador as an election monitor. We've written God knows how many articles on this, and our sixth book is about to come out about election integrity. And we do have, I have to say, we do have a social movement in this country now. There are many, many people working on election integrity, certainly after the theft of the 2000 election in Florida, and then followed by the 2004 election in Ohio. We have managed to rouse up a grassroots awareness of the fact that our elections are being stolen. And it's not just these Jim Crow procedures of preventing people of color, both blacks, Hispanics, especially Native Americans, by the way. I mean, the Dorothy Fadiman has made a superb documentary on the theft of the Native American vote in the 2004 election out on the reservations in New Mexico. So it's not just the traditional Jim Crow disenfranchisement and essentially terrorism that's involved here. There are a lot of other very subtle and some not so subtle means of stealing elections. You and I have talked a lot about voting machines, stripping voter rolls in general. But let's talk first now about something that's happening immediately, which is the Electoral College. And the attempt, the very clearly, very well-funded, very focused attempt, which is going on in Pennsylvania, for starters, of linking the Electoral College to congressional districts. And with that, let's talk about, disapportionment or, wrongful apportionment of congressional districts. I mean, we have a rotten borough system in this country that has completely entrenched a conservative majority. So let's talk first and foremost here about what is going on in Pennsylvania. And, of course, we're talking about doing it in Ohio and Wisconsin, other blue states to rig the Electoral College.
Well, it was originally endorsed by John Houston in Ohio, the Secretary of State. But it's essentially the electoral vote would follow the congressional vote, and that would mean by electing them single-member districts, which have been rigged. I mean, they're gerrymandered districts because the Republicans own the a majority of state legislatures. Essentially, you could get an overwhelming majority of the vote, and you're going to lose. Let's take a look at Ohio here. In Ohio, we have 16 congressmen, Harvey, as you well know. 12 of them are Republican. 4 of them are Democrat. Now, if the districts were drawn up correctly, you'd have 8 Dems and 8 Republicans. But under the existing system, if you go in Ohio, as they're talking about in Pennsylvania, basing it upon the congressional districts, these corrupt gerrymandered districts by the Republican Party, essentially in the last election, Obama got a majority of the vote in Ohio. And what would have happened if you switch this, Romney would have gotten 12 out of the 18 electoral votes. There's 2 kind of statewide vote representing the senators. So even though Obama would have won a majority of the vote, he would have gotten 1/3 of the electoral vote. That's our new notion of democracy. A majority means you get 1/3.
So let's clear this up here. We have in this country an electoral college, which is a legacy of slavery.
Absolutely.
There were two reasons that the Electoral College was established. One was to protect the rights of the small states against the big states. The other was to guarantee a 3/5 bonus to slave owners, whereby they were allowed to count their slaves as three-fifths of a voter, even though the Soyuz themselves were not, of course, allowed to vote at all. And so we had a situation which started in 1800, actually, where Thomas Jefferson lost the election to John Adams among eligible, admittedly, white voters, although there were black people were allowed to vote in some of the New England states. Mostly based on property ownership, but nonetheless, straight-out, eligible-to-vote count, Thomas Jefferson would have lost the election of 1800 mm-hmm. to John Adams. But because the three-fifths bonus was granted to the southern states for their slaves, Jefferson won the presidency. And that three-fifths bonus stayed in effect, of course, until 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation, followed by the abolition of slavery on the 13th Amendment in 1865. So, but the Electoral College, God knows why, remained in place. And what we have now is a system where we elect a president based on how the states go. And in each state, there are a couple of exceptions, I guess, but with each state, it's a winner-take-all system. So what the Republicans now want to do is have the states apportion the electoral votes of a state apportioned by congressional district, as you've explained. But what's the key here is that the congressional districts are completely rigged. Can you tell us about the gerrymandering and the extended gerrymandering of the congressional districts in this country, Bob Patrickis?
Well, you know, the country, there's actually a little more Democrats than Republicans, but 232 Republicans are in the Congress right now. They own a substantial lead there. Take, for example, in Ohio, what they're doing is sometimes referred to dense packing. What you do is you cram every Democratic voter in the major urban areas in Franklin County into one district. That would be the third district. And then what you do is you take a little sliver of a white suburb, say where Congressman Steve Stivers lives in Upper Arlington, or Pat Verity lives in the north east part. And then you essentially go out and grab all the Republican rural areas. So essentially what begins to happen there, Harvey, is that you have a Democratic dense-packed district. It's called the Snake on the Lake. Literally, it goes from the west side. It's a slithery thing. It's worse than the gerrymander. It slithers from west Cleveland all along the lake over to Toledo, and you pack all the Democrats, and, you know, goes along the late route there, and you grab a bunch of Democrats in Cleveland, you grab a bunch of them in Toledo, and you make a Democratic district. And then you go and create a Democratic district in Columbus. Then you create a sort of the black Democratic district in Cleveland, and you really concentrate these so they're not competitive. That, you know, they essentially follow the vote. What you've got is the Republicans, and they have 30 state governors. You've got the Republicans picking their voters and creating non-competitive districts, the majority of them all over the nation. And by the way, a special bonus, Harvey, your Wolverines are up by 17 points at the half over Florida.
Oh, fantastic. That's great news, Bob. Great to hear that. here's the deal. We have a majority of Democratic voters in this country. That's clear.
There's a plurality of independent voters, but they tend to vote Democratic. So if forced between the two parties, you have an overwhelming edge to the Democrats among all eligible voters. Then we fall down to registered voters where there's still an overwhelming edge. And what they want to do is the Republicans realize the only way they can win is among the likely voters is to make it as difficult as possible for the Democratic constituencies, young college students, the elderly, Hispanic voters that voted 71% or so for Obama, and black voters. What they want to do is make it as difficult as possible for urban liberal voters to vote, and as easy as possible for rural Republican voters to vote.
And so what we have here, and we're going to take a break in a minute here when have it run some music, Bob, but what you have is a rotten borough system where the Republicans,
oh,
who are a minority party, and clearly the party of money and entrenched financial power, have been able to rig the system so that they have a substantial majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, which is patently insane since they're a minority party in the popular vote. And
yeah, they have a clear majority. They have 232 Republicans there.
Yes.
And they also have 30-state governor where they pick up two more. That's 60 votes. So if they go to the district system you're talking about, essentially they start out with 292 electoral votes.
All right, let's take a break here, and we will come back in just a couple minutes and go deeper into the corruption of our so-called electoral system. We are back from our break here at the Soartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We've got Bob Fitrakis, one of the country's leading, if not the leading, expert on the corruption of our electoral system, our electoral process. We're on the brink, the eve of the abyss of probably a new U.S. Supreme Court decision overthrowing the ability of the Justice Department to rectify some of the injustices in our electoral process, restoring the old Jim Crow traditions back to the former Confederacy and spreading them throughout the North in other states where Republicans have gained control of the state houses and the governor's mansions and are corrupting the system to the detriment of the Democratic majority. Now, I want to make it clear here, I'm talking with the great Bob Fitrakis, that both Bob and I are Greens. We are not advocating for the Democratic Party. We supported Jill Stein for president. Bob was the Green Party candidate, and Bob was the Democratic the candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in the 3rd District in Central Ohio for the Green Party. So we're not grinding an axe here for the Democrats. What we're looking for is some kind of electoral justice and stability. And the key factor, I think, that's corrupting our what's left of our democratic process in the country right now is the rotten borough system, where we have congressional districts and, of course, state senate and the state representative districts throughout the country that are gerrymandered to favor the Republicans over the Democrats, or favor just rig the system so that a minority party in the popular vote can control the governments. Bob and I live in Ohio. A clear majority of voters in Ohio is Democratic, and yet we have a Republican governor and a state House of Representatives and a state Senate that are not only controlled by the Republicans, but they have super majorities. How does that happen in a Democratic state where the Republicans wind up with total control, not only of the state, of the governor's mansion, not only of the state Senate and the state House, but also the state Supreme Court?
Well, in Ohio, we can speak to that. Essentially, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce illegally, and I do mean that, legally bought up the Supreme Court here. They laundered money into the campaign. In fact, Cliff Arnebeck was on that case for Common Cause, is that they illegally laundered money into the Supreme Court elections, were found guilty of it, and under Ohio law, they were fined to the fullest extent of the law at the time. They got a $1,000 fine and didn't have to pay any lawyer's fees for the other time for their illegal activity.
Well, $1,000, that's a whopping fine for the...
So, yeah, now they literally bought the Supreme Court up, and then they get the rulings they need. And under Ohio law, whoever owns the apportionment board gets to gerrymander. And what they're really good at is blatant gerrymandering. And also, we should throw in, they cut a deal with the Black Caucus. There had never been a Black elected congressperson in Franklin County. So in exchange for eliminating the progressive Dennis Kucinich's seat in Cleveland, they got support from the Democratic Black Caucus to add a dense-packed urban district that could be won by a Black, which it was, Joyce Beatty in Franklin County. But it was her husband, Otto Beatty Jr., the former head of the Black Caucus, and a state senator who, in fact, cut that deal.
So what we have in Ohio is an extreme right-wing governor, a very, very right-wing state senate and house, a very right-wing Ohio Supreme Court, in a state that should be controlled by Democrats.
Yeah, absolutely. But they have that tremendous advantage with, you know, they begin by drawing up the districts. You know, when they had the power, they drew up the districts in the most blatant way possible to make sure there would be these large Republican majorities. And then remember Harvey also, in the election, the Republicans shouldn't have controlled the apportionment board. Both Ted Strickland, the former congressman who is the governor of Ohio, and Richard Cordray, who's now the consumer watchdog for Obama, both of the exit polls showed them winning. And both of them lost in really close races. And the problem with there is that private for-profit companies directly aligned politically with the Republican Party pretty much do all the computer programming for elections. The hardware and the software comes from these partisan Republican companies. And in these close elections, when the people are leaving the polls and telling the pollsters how they voted, in both of these cases, the vote ended up going towards the Republicans, even though the exit polls, which are the gold standard for proving election fraud, said that Strickland and Cordray won. And then, of course, Harvey, as you well know, the Democrats don't have enough backbone. They're missing their spine, and they're not going to stand up when the exit polls are pointing in one way and the private companies that are running Ohio elections with their computer hardware and software are saying, well, you lost that one. It was close. The Democrats aren't going to mention that that's wrong. So as long as the Democrats, you know, they'll talk about voter repression, which is obvious, but they won't go to the fact that we have absolutely undemocratic, non-transparent elections in terms of computer hardware and software, where private companies and also increasingly people that are database collectors of information, like Melissa Data, people tied literally to the NSA and the CIA, retired directors and people who work for those agencies, collecting data and being heavily involved in counting votes.
Yeah, and Bob, you're not suggesting that any American would flip an election using voting machines to thwart the will of the people. You wouldn't be suggesting that.
Harvey, I'm suggesting unless there's transparency, people steal any election. Look, sixth grade class president, unless you got transparency and you're counting the ballots in front, somebody's going to stuff the ballot box. Homecoming queen, someone's going to stuff the ballot box. The thing we've learned about democracy is unless you have transparency, you know, I don't care if it's Lyndon Johnson or John Kennedy or the son of the former CIA director George Herbert Walker Bush's boy, W, they're all going to have a tendency to steal.
Yes. Okay. So now here's an interesting situation. You and I have been pushing the reality of the possibility or the likelihood or certainly the ability of incumbents to steal elections on voting machines. And every time we bring this up during an election year, the Democrats flip out and say, you can't say that because you're going to discourage people from coming out to vote, because if they think they're going to cast a vote on a voting machine and it's going to be stolen, they won't bother to vote. So here we are. We're 3 years out from the next presidential election, a year out from the next governor's election in Ohio and the off-year elections. Why don't the Democrats or people other than the people in power do something now about electronic voting machines? Clearly, electronic voting machines are perfectly designed to steal elections. And so rather than whine and moan at the last minute about how all these complaints are discouraging people from voting, why not get rid of these electronic voting machines now, so that when the day comes, when election day comes, everybody will have a fair shake? You and I have been advocating what, Bob? Tell us, please, what we want instead of electronic voting machines.
Well, we've argued we want what they went back to in Ireland, and they use it in most democracies. In what I witnessed when I was the International Election Observer in El Salvador in 1994, that is the only thing the guerrillas and the death squads, the left and the right, could agree upon is, you put your ballot in a transparent box so no one can tamper it with, so everyone can see it. You open it in front of the world, including the media and election observers and all the parties, and you count publicly. It's just unbelievable that someone would suggest, hey, we're going to hire partisan political people from private for-profit companies, and they're going to write the source code and secretly tell us who won. It's absurd. We want transparency. Every single day we read about cyber attacks, from China, North Korea. We know computers can be compromised. And, during the Kenyan election, right, they turned the computers off there in certain areas for a while. And now, there's charges of election tampering. Shockingly, well, Harvey, you can program a computer. There's even a job category, I understand, that's called computer programmer. And not only that, you have a 17-year-old kid that just wrote an algorithm to go out and sold it to Yahoo to collect data, right? You can create algorithms in computer that will tell you the result of the election ahead of time.
Right, because they'll set it up. And so the reality is we want hand-counted paper ballots, universal hand-counted paper ballots. We want at least a four-day weekend for voting, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, count the votes on Tuesday or count them on Wednesday, however you want to do it. The Constitution says that the national elections have to be on the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. So it can't be November 1st. It has to be November 2nd through the 8th. But nonetheless, we want it to, if you have to include that day, that's fine. But we want it so that people can have the full weekend to vote. We like advanced voting.
And just call it early voting if you want. They do that in many states already.
Yes, and it's very successful. It's improved voter turnout. We complain in this country that we have very low voter turnout. Well, not everybody can get off work on a Tuesday to come and vote. It used to be on Tuesday because that was market day, but things have changed a bit since the
right after Harvest Moon and bringing in the final harvest. You rode
right.
The horse into town on Monday, and we're there for voting and selling goods on Tuesday.
That's right, and they had to harvest the hemp crops so they could use that to make the paper for the ballots. So that's what we want. We want universal hand-counted paper ballots. We want a very full and easily available advanced voting, extended voting time, so that working people can actually come to the polls and vote. And we want, of course, a national holiday for voting. And allow the kids to get out of school and high schools and colleges to come run the polls and do the vote counting. And that would be a tremendous boon to our democracy. We want elimination, total elimination of all electronic voting machines, including the Scantrons. Talk a bit about the Scantrons. People say, you cast your ballot on a paper ballot and then it's zipped through the Scantron. So at least you have the best of both worlds. In fact, it turns out in many cases to be the the worst of both worlds, right, Bob Strakis?
Well, the value of the Scantron is that you actually have a ballot. The downside of the Scantron is you're counting these with, you know, computer chips and computer programs. So, again, the one case that we documented of election fraud in Ohio in 2004, we're on the, you know, the scanned ballots. And the good news is we could actually count the paper and prove that it was, in fact, stolen. The bad news is they did it with their software in their counting machine for the Scantron.
Right.
Ballot said one thing, they got it wrong by switching 2,500 votes from Kerry to Bush. You know, and they always want you to believe that was a glitch. You know,
yeah,
the machine just messed up with the program, and 5,000 more votes went to Bush because 2,500 carries get attributed to Bush in Miami County.
So let's, to review here, because I want to move on, you know, we've got a situation now where the Jim Crow is going to come back or appears poised to come back if the Supreme Court throws out this section of the Voting Rights Act. It allows the feds to get rid of some of the worst abuses in the state. We have a totally gerrymandered system. And by the way, the word gerrymander, in case you don't know, I had mentioned this before when I had Jill Stein on the show. Gerrymander comes from Eldridge Gerry, or Jerry. I can't remember his first name. It wasn't Eldridge Gerry. I'm not sure it's the same one. In Massachusetts in the 1790s, a politician named Gerry, and he, last name, and he set up the districts, the representational districts in Massachusetts, and they were so rigged and so obviously corrupt that people said they all looked like salamanders, and that's where we got the term.
They had like claws and teeth.
Yeah, right.
And now we have one in Ohio that literally looks like, you know, the old Archie comic. It looks like Jughead with his hat on.
Yeah, right. It's amazing what they do. And then, you know, we have electronic voting machines, which are completely riggable, which actually can be flipped driving by. I mean, you know, you can do drive-by Wi-Fi and flip an election. Don't even have to get out of your car. Don't even have to touch the voter memory.
Yeah, steal it from the drive-by or steal it from the parking lot.
There you go. Absolutely. So we want elimination of all electronic voting machines and the installation everywhere of universal paper ballots. We also, of course, want automatic, we want an extended voting period, you know, a four-day weekend at very least, so the people, working people, don't have to lose time on their Tuesdays. They can vote on a Friday, a Saturday if you're not Jewish, a Sunday if you are Jewish, you know, and a Saturday and Sunday for Muslims because they take off Friday. Some do. And then Monday as well, and even Tuesday if we have to. So there's plenty of time for people to come out and vote. At least one of those needs to be a national holiday. And nothing but paper ballots, totally hand-counted and exposed to the public. Now, also, in order to have our elections have some kind of integrity, the big one, you know, the 800-pound gorilla is money in politics. I mean, we now have the Citizens United decision, court decision overturning the restriction on corporate spending in Montana, the complete ability of corporations to purchase our elections. How do we get rid of that, Bob?
Well, I think you got to go to public financing of elections. Austin, Texas has a good model. We used to have a good model in Michigan when I lived up there in the 1980s. I think you've got to reverse this model that says, and I think Move to Amend is right here, that corporations are people. And Citizens United absolutely has to be overturned. I mean, when, and again, here's the problem, Harvey. Obama's got to fight for somebody who believes in democracy on the Supreme Court. And when they get there, you know, the Republican, the far right wing conservative justices there have no problem in turning laws, overturning laws that have been in place since the 1880s. And usually the people the Democrats put there won't overturn a law from, you know, 2009, Citizens United. You've got to get somebody on that Supreme Court that has a respect for democracy and doesn't want our system awash in money and controlled by, you know, this kleptocracy, this rule by thieves and plutocrats.
But, of course, you know, another corrupt part of our system is the filibuster in the Senate. It's hard to conceive if, you know, if, say, Justice Ginsburg, who's, you know, aging and not well, if she resigns and Obama tries to put somebody on the court, he's going to have to get 61 votes in the U.S. Senate. And the Democrats, of course, have done nothing about the filibuster rule. So we have even yet another entrenched tumor in our process here that denies democracy.
Well, you know, I'd let them talk till they keeled over from exhaustion. You know, it's sort of, you know, let them filibuster. Let the Dems spell out, you know, that they have a right to make an appointment. You know, that the Republicans spend all of their time attacking and not compromising, and the Dems do nothing but run to the center. That's what allows the Republican Party to overturn more than 100 years of precedent that restricted the ability of anonymous money and the filthy rich to pollute the election process. But, I mean, they simply know what power is, and they realize, look, man, we don't got the votes. You know, what we should do is let them manipulate the system and spend as much money, the rich people, as they want to win.
So, you know, there's so much barrier here to having a decent democracy. Also, I want to throw in, you know, the little detail of the inability of the People District of Columbia to have senators. You know, there are no black senators in the United States Senate. Well, there's one, actually, the temporary appointee from Massachusetts is a black man. But that seat's going to go, hopefully, to Ed Markey. And otherwise, there are no black people in the U.S. Senate at this point in time, which is astounding. Yet the District of Columbia, which has more people in it than either Wyoming or Vermont, I believe, has no U.S. senators. We know that both of them, if D.C. was a state, would be black. That's not happening. So we have my niece, nephew, and sister all live in Washington, D.C., and they have no senatorial representation. So another corrupt
revolution over that, Harvey.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, they do have license plates in Washington D.C. The official license plate says "taxation without representation." I kind of like that, actually. So yet another situation in our electoral system that mitigates against democracy. But how do we, in fact, finally eliminate money from politics? I mean, is it going to take a constitutional amendment? Is that the way we're going to have to go?
They could do it through legislation, but the people got to demand it. We could encourage good money over bad, Harvey. We could say that donations under $100 in district are matched 2-to-1. In fact, part of the problem, you know, in the Green Party is, which actually took the public money, is they're now being heavily, heavily audited, and they were warned by Ralph Nader, don't take the public money. It's a trap with the minor parties. It's almost they want, you know, President Obama, and they want, you know, Mr. Romney there, Mitt Romney, to go and get all this private, corrupt special interest money. What we should have is a system where everyone gets equal time on TV, radio, given free mass media, and the parties raise money, and it's matched through the public coffers. And the good money, in-district small money, is, in fact, rewarded over the out-of-the-district and, God knows, out-of-the-country now with foreign companies' money.
Yeah. I guess when you mentioned media access, the one interesting state this year that for the first time one of the networks ran debates with the four so-called secondary candidates, Jill Stein from the Green Party, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian, also pro-legalization of marijuana, and two other candidates, I can't remember who they were, But it was a breath of fresh air to see those four people debating substance as opposed to Romney and Obama that just kind of danced around each other and didn't say much.
Most of them, they get their money from the same place. That's been the problem with the Democratic Party, really, since the creation of the Democratic Leadership Council, the DLC, in the 80s. Essentially,
right,
they've become the junior partners in the global corporate capitalist system.
Yeah, exactly. So we're almost out of time here. I'm talking with Bob Petraeus, my co-author on 5 books, soon to be 6, about election protection. What's our new book going to be called, Bob?
I think we're going with your name on the on the corporations. Your official title there, I think, is winning out.
Corporate money and whatever it is, corporate money and the theft of our electoral process. But this one, we'll look back on the election of 2012. We believe that Obama actually got a bigger majority than one would suspect, but we know what happened.
But there was a back door, and they counted the votes in Chattanooga, Tennessee, on a near site.
Yes, and you know what? We're almost out of time here, Bob. A last word on our electoral process here before we got to go.
Full transparency. Get rid of the partisan for-profit corporations secretly counting our vote, Harvey.
All right, Bob. Thank you so much. There is no excuse for losing our democracy, and Bob Petraeus and I will continue to be talking about this. Thank you so much for being with us for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you, Bob. We'll talk to you next week about another issue on saving our planet. This has been Harvey Watson. Thanks so much for being with us.